Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 52, titled The Pure Land and Lotus Sutras.
But I need first to cover two more kinds of sutras, and one of them is the Lotus Sutra. Maybe I should do Pure Land Sutra first. So one is Pure Land Sutra. And Pure Land Sutra is something that ended up being the biggest type of Buddhism, most popular type of Buddhism in East Asia. And in Japan today, Shin Buddhism is the biggest denomination among Buddhists. And it's a kind of amazing story of how it became. The founder of it and everything is like a Luther kind of person from the 14th century, Shinran, his name was. And he was a monk at near Kyoto, Mount Hiei. And he was a frustrated monk like Luther. And he was not getting anywhere in his meditations. But he was getting somewhere, actually, in that he was getting to understand his unconscious. And he found these urges, you know, primal eros and thanatos, as Freud would have called them, his erotic and his destructive impulses in down there, hostile, aggressive impulses. And I guess he felt maybe he had some hatred of his father. You never get that from the biography, you don't know. Some Oedipal complex energy he found in there, and very likely. And then he had this vision when he was reading the Pure Land Sutra, which you have in this Buddhist Mahayana text, which Ibad gave you the coordinates for in the CPT, in case you had a chance to glance at it. And he noticed that in that, the vows of Amida, or Amitabha, Amida they say in Japanese, but Amitabha, boundless light Buddha, when he was a bodhisattva called Dharmakara, which means mine of the Dharma, or mine of teaching, treasure of the teaching, he made a vow, when I don't want to become a Buddha, he said, the one who eventually became Amitabha Buddha, he said, I refuse to become a Buddha unless when anybody hears my name and repeats it with an iota of faith, they will be born in my Buddha land, which will be a perfect land free of any kind of obstacles and problems and sufferings, and blissful land in which they can try to come to enlightenment. And then Shinran read that, and suddenly he felt embraced by the compassionate energy of Amitabha, and he had a kind of vision of the Sukhavati paradise in the West. And he... if you just read a little bit, I didn't really want to read it, but it describes these extraordinary visions, but which we already had a little taste of in the Avatamsaka. But it describes like a heavenly description, really elaborate, lush, you know, completely seductive to the senses, vision of, you know, like jewels and jewel ground and luminous lights and pure energy in the air and, you know, just sitting in a lotus, whatever, you know. Kind of boring sounding in one way, but all totally blissful and totally cooled out situation. And there's this one sutra here that I think is particularly interesting to give you kind of the essence of the Pure Land movement. We don't know whether it was a huge movement in India, because everything is erased about what was in India. All the art is destroyed, everything, you know, by the Islamic occupation of India for about 800 years, 700 years. And so we lost that track of that, but very big in East Asia, you know. It's and the biggest school, bigger than Zen in Japan. And the context in which it's taught is very poignant, because it's that story of Ajatashatru, the young prince, whose name means, Ajatashatru means, the name means one of whom the enemy has not been born. So it's a hero's name, meaning nobody can ever stand up to this guy. It's a warrior class, right, in India. So Ajatashatru means one who there can't even be an enemy for. You know. But then Devadatta, in his attempt to attack and destroy the Buddha, remember the half-brother of Buddha who was endlessly jealous of him, he tells the Jatashatru, what that means is that your father was told by a soothsayer that before you were born, you were going to be his enemy. So he gave you the name, my enemy already before he was born. And he tried to throw you off a cliff, but your mother wouldn't let him. So he stoked Ajatashatru's natural Oedipal thing and wished to take over the kingdom, you know, when he became kind of a young buck, from his father who was sponsoring the Buddha and the monks, and he wasn't making war on anybody. And he built on that, and then he got Ajatashatru to usurp the throne, imprisoned the father to starve to death, and you know, patricide, in other words, you know, regicide and patricide combined. And then there's this thing where he wasn't dying. He kept surviving, and then he was trying to figure out how that happened, and then he found out that his mother visited the father, and before she would go see him, she would cover her body with flour and wheat and sesame powder and whatever, food, in other words, and then he would lick the food. And so he was staying alive. So then he was going to kill her with his sword, and he was dissuaded by his doctor, and you know, not to add matricide in that way, but then he did lock her up, and they both starved to death. And while they were waiting to starve to death, as in this meditation on Buddha Amitayus, which is one of the sutras on page in this Buddhist Mahayana text, it begins on page 161. And although there's weird numbering, it's the second volume in the one binding. So it's the second batch of pages. The first, there's the Buddhacharita pages in this book, and then there's the second batch. So it's 161 in the second batch. And there is where Buddha comes magically, which by now you're used to this happening in his Mahayana Sutras, and with his crowd of monks. And then he teaches her the vision of the Pure Land. He tells her to look at the sunset out the window of the prison, the royal prison chamber there, and then see the reddish glow of the sun, and then use her imagination to project through that and think of this glorious lotus land where they will go, and sort of there's a better world. So it's taught in the context of the royal family, supposedly the top people in the society, and yet this, it's a terrible thing where the son is killing the parents and usurping the throne. I mean, it's like samsara. It's a horrible samsara. So that's this Amitāya Dhyana Sutra. And it tells that story in this meditation on Buddha Amitayus. And finally, he gives the thing, and then he tells how to see the country full of seven jewels and, you know, divine palaces. And it's really elaborate. We're not used to that in the West because there's a few mystics, but we don't have a lot of writing in the West of what heaven is like. You know, Dante mentions singing in the choir, but it's not really too lush, and it's not too widespread. The Western culture is denied, in a way, that kind of level of lush imagination from Mediterranean, I mean by that Western. And, you know, it's just typical this. When thou hast seen, you see the sun, let that image remain clear and fixed, whether thine eyes be shut or open, such is the perception of the sun, which is the first meditation. Next, you should form the perception of water, gaze on the water clear and pure, and let this image remain clear and fixed. Afterwards, never allow thy thought to be scattered and lost. By the way, Monet, you know the painting Water Lilies? Do any of you know that painting? There's a scholar, Jacqueline Voss, who used to be the curator of the Berkeley Art Museum, and I think she's an independent writer and scholar now, but she studied the influences on European painters in the 19th and 20th centuries. And she found that they were very influenced by things coming from Japan and from Asia. And particularly, there were some kind of prints that she traced that Monet and these people had seen of the Pure Land type of thing, or some of the Chinese caves and things like that. So water lilies may well be a kind of Pure Land vision for the French. Indirectly, it's kind of fun. And also, by the way, that when that came to China initially, the Confucian ministers of the not I think Han, but post-Han, the different fragmented but post-Han dynasties, there's something called the Book of Mo, which is a sort of warning against Buddhism. And one of the warnings that those ministers wrote to the emperor was, don't let the Pure Land Buddhists into China. This will really be bad because they go in caves and they make temples in caves, and then the walls of caves, they do murals. And in those murals, they paint this exquisite land of brilliant colors and angels flying around playing trumpets. And the palace of Amitabha and the body of Amitabha and of Avalokiteshvara and Mahasamaprapta, the main bodhisattvas there, and all the beings sitting in the lotuses are so exquisite and so magnificent that when the farmer, peasant, subject of your majesty goes there and sees that, and then they come back to town and they look up at your palace and they'll think it's like a shack. So you'll lose their allegiance, and they'll shift their allegiance and their admiration to the sort of divine form of Buddha in the Pure Land of Amitabha. So don't let them in there. That'll corrupt all your workers, and you'll lose their adulation. So this did appeal to the masses, in other words, people who weren't lay people, and often illiterate, uneducated people, and who couldn't go and study selflessness and renunciation and compassion and this sort of thing in a formal way from these elaborate and logic, etc. And they weren't even literate, but they had an idea of a kind of happy hunting ground, and they were, because of their social status, sort of deprived of aesthetic pleasure to a great degree, and they were just working away there in their village plant, and that whole thing of planting rice seedlings, what it must do to your back, I can't even believe it. My age, it's really difficult. So this particularly did appeal to the masses, I'm sure, of India, but we don't have really good evidence about that because of the destruction of the Buddhist art in India. But we know it from East Asia, how powerful it was among the masses. Because it's really basically like going to heaven, and it's likely that in Japan today, in China today, people who do Namo Amido Fo, they say in Chinese Namo Amida Butsu, they say in Japanese, Korean, they also do it. They probably think that getting to the Pure Land is getting enlightened. So it becomes just like going to heaven, you know. There's probably not much more underworld understood, although it says clearly in all the Pure Land Sutras, well, when you get here, then you're in class 24 hours. 24/7. Because the Buddha never goes away. He's always there. He doesn't attain parinirvana. You're in the lotus. You don't sleep. You don't eat. There's no sexual differentiation. You don't need to go on a date. You have this special kind of body, and the energy just comes in through your pores from the air. As one Zen master I know told Gary Snyder once at a conference that I organized many years ago, he said, oh, you Americans, you would have liked the Pure Land. And then people said, well, why not, Roshi? He said, well, through a translator, he said, well, I could just hear that poem written by a famous poet here, Gary Snyder. Don't go up to that there Pure Land because they have no diners and no bathrooms, no toilet. Gary didn't like that too much. But it was really, really funny. No diners and no toilets. So then you look at it, then you should learn to form the perception of ice. As thou seest the ice shining and transparent, you should imagine the appearance of lapis lazuli. After that has been done, thou wilt see the ground consisting of lapis lazuli, transparent and shining both within and without. Beneath this ground of lapis lazuli, there will be seen a golden banner with the seven jewels, diamonds, and the rest supporting the ground. It extends to the eight points of the compass, and thus the eight corners of the ground are perfectly filled up. Every side of the eight quarters consists of 100 jewels. Every jewel has 1,000 rays, and every ray has 84,000 colors, which when reflected in the ground of lapis lazuli look like 1,000 millions of suns, and it is difficult to see them all one by one. Over the surface of that ground of lapis lazuli, there are stretched golden ropes intertwined crosswise. Divisions are made by means of strings of seven jewels, with every part clear and distinct. Each jewel has rays of 500 colors, which look like the flowers or like the moon and stars. Lodged high up in the open sky, these rays form a tower of rays, whose stories and galleries are 10 millions in number and built of 100 jewels. Both sides of the tower have each 100 millions of flowery banners, furnished and decked with numberless musical instruments. Eight kinds of cool breezes proceed from the brilliant rays. When those musical instruments are played, they emit the sounds, suffering, non-existence, impermanence, and non-self, or selflessness, I should say. Such is the perception of the water, which is the second meditation. Anyway, I don't want to take time because I will take time. But it goes on like that. And if you sort of just try to read it, you can't really visualize it, but it just kind of creates a kind of luminous feeling in your mind with read it. And you can see how they resorted to art. And all over Asia, they would carve out these huge cave temples. And there's still some that exist, Dunhuang, Lungmen, Luoyang. In China, there's still some that still exist. They are quite beautiful and marvelous. As I said, they are Monet water lilies from ancient times. And with Buddhas in the middle of them and palaces and things like that. So that's the Pure Land thing, which was quite mass popular. And accounts for the massive spread of Buddhism throughout Asia without wars and without crusades or conquests and so on. So then the other one type is the lotus one, which is kind of very far out in its own way too. Although it doesn't, it says that this is a pure land, like Vimalakirti, but more expansively. It says that this here is a pure land, but then it says this is a pure land that if you see, it really is like beautiful and exquisite, like a heavenly pure land, this land. And when Buddha's about to teach the Lotus Sutra, a whole bunch of monks get up and leave. And then Shariputra or Ananda, somebody says to him, I didn't bring the book, so I have to just remember it. Ananda says to him, well, Buddha, they're leaving. You should do something. Call them back. What is this? And Buddha says, no, let them go. This particular sutra is not for everyone. And then, so he lets them leave. So there's the idea that it's a little bit on the edge of esoteric. It's a non-esoteric sutra, but it's on the edge of esoteric. And then he gives all this talk about, he totally contradicts the Four Noble Truths. He says there's no suffering, everything is perfect, everything is made of gold, my body is everywhere, and relax, take a break, it's all gold, it's all perfect. And people are like, what? And then Shariputra even comes back and down and says, wait a minute, after a while, he gives all this kind of contradictory type of statements to the basic Buddhism. And then Shariputra comes and says, when I first heard you doing that, Buddha, I thought you were Mara pretending to be Buddha, and I ran away. But then when I was walking in the forest, I realized, no, that couldn't have been Mara, that really's got to be Buddha. Maybe I've got to go back and learn something. So then I went back. But now that I went back, why didn't you tell us if it's all perfect and everything is just great as is? Why didn't you tell us that? And then he gives the famous parable. Actually, it's the first occurrence in world literature of the prodigal son parable, actually. Where he gives a parable about a father, and then he has the prodigal son who goes off. But it's a different use of the prodigal son story. And the son, is a big libertine, and he goes out drinking and all this, and he wrecks himself and disappears and even forgets who his father is. He just completely changes his world. And then, after a while, he doesn't really repent, but he runs out of steam in his partying, and he has to find a job, he decides. And so he comes back to his father's vast lands and estates, a very wealthy father, and he just seeks a job, and he doesn't even remember that it's his father. But he's working in the field kind of thing. Then the father recognizes that's the son, and then the father observes his work and so on, and then promotes him gradually, but doesn't tell him, you're my long-lost son. Just keeps like getting him more and more healthy and more together and more proud of whatever level of work he's doing, starting at the very like cleaning the latrines, And so he doesn't say, oh, all this is yours, type of thing. He brings him up bit by bit. And then when he finally reaches a certain place, then he says, oh, by the way, you are my son who got lost. And you didn't remember, and ding, Now, why is that? Remember, there you are. And then at that point, the son is able to sort of own it, because he was such a wreck before he couldn't have owned it. So it's the prodigal son thing, but with a different twist. And the twist being that you couldn't be told it was perfect when you were such a mess, because you would have, you wouldn't have known what to do about it. And then he also tells a story about a father who has a bunch of children, who are playing in a house that is burning. And the house is burning down around their ears, but they're so absorbed in their play that there's no way they're going to get out of there. And so then the father knows what the different kind of toys the different children like. And he says to some of them, there's a deer cart outside. I've just got a brand new bunch of deer carts, so you can go out and race around in a deer cart. And he tells some others, here, there's some horse carts out there. You can go around and raise your horse cart. And then he tells some others, there's some ox carts out there. You can go around and ride in your ox cart. And then when they get out, all there is ox carts. And then Buddha says, well, would you blame that father? That he didn't tell the ones who wouldn't like an ox cart that it was an ox cart out there. Or the ones who wouldn't like an ox cart that there were, you know, that he told them horse, deer, whatever they liked, he told them. And then when they got out, then he told them what there was, you know. And then they obviously are not mad at him as they look back in the house that's collapsing in flames. They're not mad that they were misled. Maybe some. There might be some spoiled princess who's like, come on, where's my dear card? I'm going back in the burning house. But not really. And then there's another one where, another one in the sutra connected to the Lotus Sutra called the Mahaparinirvana Mahayana Sutra. It's different than the Pali Nirvana Sutra. And there he has two wonderful ones. And one of them is a mother who has a newborn child who has a strange disease. And the disease is such that the child would be harmed by drinking her milk. And the doctor gives the child medicine and says, this medicine will cure the child, and then they'll be able to drink the milk in a month. Or whatever, I don't remember how many months. But the mother then says to the doctor, but you know, how can I want to give him milk now. How can I not give him milk? And he says, well, you'll just have to do that. And then the mother is really distraught and doesn't know, the child's upset. So then the doctor says, here, I'll give you a foul medicine, a foul paste, and you smear that on your nipples so that when the child comes to suck, it'll go, and a few more times you do that, and then you give it like whatever the medicine is and some soy milk or whatever you give. Once it doesn't want, you doesn't want your nipple anymore. And so she does that, and then the child recovers with the medicine, and then she can nurse the child. So the point is, she couldn't nurse, so the Buddha couldn't nurse us with the vision of perfection of the Lotus Sutra, and the infinite life of the Buddha type of idea, until we already had gotten over a certain degree of egotism and self-enclosure and paranoia and so on. Something like that. So they use that. And then I think the last one is also in Parinirvana that I like, where these sons of a doctor break into his medicine cabinet and take a bunch of medicines they're not supposed to and become demented and crazed and paranoid. And he comes back and, oh no, he says, this is terrible. And what can I do? But they're so paranoid, they won't take any advice he gives them. So he takes the antidote and he puts it back in the same cabinet and locks it up and leaves again. And then, of course, they break into the cabinet to get more, and then they take the antidote and then they're cool. It's this kind of thing in the Lotus Sutra. And then, the one thing that I really like, which is it's the Buddhist return of the mummy. I don't know how many of you saw the movie The Mummy, but I rather like it. I don't know. Good special effects. I mean, it's been made a million times because there's so limited in imagination in Hollywood. But anyway, the recent one. Anyway, this return of the mummy is very different. Because Buddha then said, okay, now I'm going to tell you about the Lotus Sutra, once he sort of told the monks who are protesting, like, what do you mean there's no suffering and so on. And he says, okay, I'm going to tell you. But, you know, I want you to know there is a Buddha, billion of life of galaxies and trillion of big bangs ago, who vowed after he became a Buddha that he wanted to always come back in his jewel stupa whenever any Buddha in any world system taught the Lotus Sutra. So he said, so do you guys want to see the Buddha present as Prabhutaratna, profusion of jewels? Do you want to see Prabhutaratna Buddha? Then they said, yes, we'd like to see him. So then suddenly this huge stupa, and again, it's typical, you know, hyperbole, it's like 30, you know, 100 stories high, bigger than Trump Tower. And it has what's called a harmika, a place where an image is a little doorway high up on the stupa. And somehow they all levitate, the whole assembly, and they're all up there around the harmika. And then Buddha goes and he pulls the bolt back on the harmika and it actually goes creak. It goes creak like that. And they describe that as a sutra. And then he opens it and there's Prabhutaratna Buddha as a mummy. He's a dead Buddha. And then the dead Buddha says to the live Buddha, says, Shakyamuni, good man, you're teaching the Lotus Sutra. Come sit down next to me and teach it. And so he says, okay, and he sits down in the center of the stupa, and then he teaches the Lotus Sutra. And so you have the concept of the dead Buddha and the live Buddha sitting together, meaning nobody dies, if you follow me. Buddhas are immortal. And then there's a long story about different things, and there are different marvelous moments. And this is another. This is one of the other biggest movements in China, Korea, Japan, is the what's called the Tendai school in China and Tendai in Japan, based on the Lotus Sutra, on that vision. And in the modern time, there are different. There's some fairly fanatical Lotus Sutra monks, but the really great one that I like, Fuji Guruji. He died at 108 in India, not long ago. And during when the Japanese were invading Manchuria, he used to go out dressed in a soldier's uniform, and then, you know, impersonating a soldier somehow, he would get among the troops there and then the boat. And then when he'd get to the trenches, he'd start walking up and down between the lines, you know, of the people fighting, and he'd rip off his suit like Superman, and he had Buddhist monks' robes on, orange robes, and take this drum. And he'd go around, Namo Nyoho Renge Kyo, which is the Japanese way of reciting the name of the Lotus Sutra. Because they think that just reciting the name is like the name of Buddha is enough. You recite the name of the Lotus Sutra and you're in the Buddha's lotus world. And it's all perfect and nothing can die. And he'd walk with bullets whistling. He'd walk up and down. But then also it was annoying the generals. Because on both sides, because the troops on both sides who had a touch of Buddhism in them, they did, or everyone in East Asia does, you know, they may not be formally Buddhist, but they all know about it, and they had into some aspects of it, and then they'd stop shooting, because they don't want to shoot this monk, who's going, Namo Nyoho Renge Kyo, Namo Nyoho, which is like Namo Saddharma Pundarika Sutra in Japanese. And then he would be grabbed and arrested, sent back to Japan, and then he would sneak out and do it more. And unfortunately, most of the other Buddhist schools in Japan were so scared of the Japanese imperialists that they kind of catered to the whole thing. You know, they just didn't really oppose it too much. Individuals did, but the institutions of the schools did not particularly. But that guy really did. And then finally, they got tired of taking him back from the trenches, the Japanese government, in the 30s. Because this was before the whole war had broken out. They were just invading China. And they got tired of it, so they banished him to India. And then he became a friend of Gandhi's, actually. And it is said that he's the one who put the Ashoka pillar on the Indian flag. Otherwise, Gandhi was going to put a spinning wheel, you know, for making khadi, you know, for making cotton. And they thought, come on, you know, India, you had your glory in the old days. Put the Ashoka lion wheel on there. And supposedly, people say. And they build stupas all over the place. They have stupas in Massachusetts and London and all over the world. These Lotus Sutra people, they went to Iran during the Iran-Iraq War, marched around them among the Muslims. Namo Nyoho Renge Kyo. I didn't hear too many getting killed. I'm sure they're trying to get a visa to go to ISIS. And that might get beheaded there, so I hope they don't. But they are like that. They're great in a way, because they somehow are into this thing of, if you just shift your perception, the world is different. You know, they do that. That's their yoga. You know, so that's the Lotus Sutra. So in a way, the Pure Land thing, you can, if in a simple category, if you were to remember, although just putting it in a category doesn't help. If you expose to your mind to it a little bit by reading it, you'll get the flavor of it best. But the Pure Land is where this world is kind of the ordinary samsara, and then there's a Pure Land that's like a mandala or something that's sort of close to a place where you can realize nirvana. And then the other one is where that's actually the way things are here, like the Vimalakirti and the Lotus are in that category. Because Vimalakirti is definitely, remember, Buddha shows the whole interwoven universe with his toe first, then in Vimalakirti, then he sends out to that incense or perfume, Pure Land, brings the perfume food back, and then has a dialogue, and Vimalakirti debates those bodhisattvas who come back to see what Shakyamuni's Buddha land is like, and he defends the smelly, imperfect, seemingly imperfect, you know, an annoying, corrupt, crappy Buddha land of Shakyamuni's as best, because it's where you can develop your kindness and compassion.